A comment here from Josh that says Mission Impossible 2 makes me want to punch a dolphin.
Yeah.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
And you're questioning our journalistic integrity.
No, I'm questioning your hearing. You hear reasonable and tortious interference. I hear potential Brown and Williamson lawsuit jeopardizing the sale of CBS to Westinghouse. I hear shut the segment down, cut Wigand loose, obey orders, and fuck off. That's what I hear.
Hello.
Hey.
Hello. How's everybody doing?
Welcome.
Acknowledging the chat, looks like J.C. Davis is just absolutely ruling that thing. Or at least people named J.C. are ruling that thing.
Yeah, there's another J.C. today. That's what we need. Everybody change your username to J.C. so no one knows who anybody is.
Yeah, exactly. this is Recotopia episode 16. The big recommend today will be The Insider. My name is Chris Atkinson.
And I'm Jeremy Scott. And every time we do that, I think about Incredible Burt Wonderstone.
Yeah.
When he goes, I'm Burt Wonderstone. And Steve Buscemi goes, and I'm Anton Marvelton.
Hey, do you want to get into our small recommends?
It's no big deal.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
I do. You want me to start?
Yeah, go ahead.
I did not know this documentary even existed.
Mm.
Flipping channels a few days ago, I stumbled on a Showtime documentary called Sheryl, and it's about Sheryl Crow.
Oh,
and
nice.
I have always been a big Sheryl Crow fan.
Mm-hmm.
Her first record came out when I was in college, and that was exactly the right sound at the right time for a college student. She was incredibly popular with the whole campus, as I remember it. This is one of those documentaries where she's sitting in a chair being interviewed, probably for hours at a time, and then we cut to all kinds of stock behind the scenes, backstage footage, as she tells these stories. And I just enjoyed it. I don't know that it's like an award-winning documentary, but I learned a few new things. Like, maybe this was bigger news at the time, but the internet wasn't so huge. But when Leaving Las Vegas was like a certified hit,
mm-hmm.
she gave an interview where one of the things she said was that it was kind of autobiographical. And I guess technically she had co-written the song with her bandmates, and her bandmates weren't super happy with that. But also they had based it on a book called Leaving Las Vegas.
Oh, really?
And not long after this, the guy who wrote that book killed himself.
No.
And she breaks down
mm-hmm.
When she's remembering this. Now, the documentary doesn't say this, but when I went and Googled it, the man's family has said it had nothing to do with her song,
mm-hmm.
Which suggests to me there were well-known other underlying issues that his family knew about. They wouldn't make that statement just to make her feel better.
Mm-hmm.
But even knowing that, I can imagine that would crush a person.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that kind of casts the rest of her career in a new light for me, that she was carrying that weight as she moved forward creatively. I think if you're a Sheryl Crow fan or just a general big music fan, this is a documentary to add to your list.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very long. It's like an hour and a half. I really enjoyed it. So there you go. Sheryl on Showtime.
I'm guessing Lance Armstrong comes up.
Yes, briefly.
Okay.
It's much more about the music than her personal life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Staying on some of the documentary stuff, I watched one on Hulu called Too Funny to Fail about Ooh. the Dana Carvey show, which is a show that I never watched. It and I didn't have a chance to. If I may have vaguely, and during, this came out in what, 96, I think, is when the Dana Carvey show was made.
Sounds right.
During that time, 1996, I was not watching very much TV. Even some of the shows that I was watching back then, I had stopped, like Seinfeld and things like that. I would occasionally catch a new episode of one of those and whatever. So I was way more into movies in 1996 than I was into TV shows. But I think I remember saying, I think I'll give that a look sometime, but it was canceled after like eight episodes. So, but that was a big story back then, is Dana Carvey left Saturday Night Live and wanted to create a new sketch show. And he did it with Robert Smigel. Robert Smigel, they hired some people who are like, you know, would become all timers later on in life. So like Steve Carell before he was anything, Stephen Colbert. Wow. Louis C.K. was a writer on this show. There was Charlie Kaufman was a writer on this show.
Holy crap.
So they have just a who's who of industry names before they were even names. And I love that how the documentary goes into how they were picking these people, because they go to all the usual places where people try to find funny people, like Second City and stuff like that. So at the time in Second City, Smigel had been hearing about this legendary performer named Steve Carell, but he wasn't there that night. And he said, but the understudy was kicking ass that night, and it was Stephen Colbert. And, they went through all this, process. So they actually ended up getting them both, but it's so funny showing all this stuff. They showed Colbert's like audition, which he has a newborn and he has a newborn in his audition, and he's talking about all this stuff, and he's like come, I really need this job, and blah 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 blah. And Stephen Colbert's like, I don't know, maybe they hired me based on that. And Dana Carvey's like, no, that was disturbing, we didn't hire him based on that. It's interesting to me. I think that even if you didn't watch the show, and I've seen some skits from it since, but it shows you that a lot of times you can have the funniest people in the world. It doesn't matter. You have to set the tone immediately. And you have to have the right set of circumstances. And one of the big things that they talk about was their lead-in into their show was Home Improvement. Home Improvement, which is a big family show. People gather around and watch this with their family. It's very inoffensive. And then Dana Carvey show comes on, and it's nothing but like non-family stuff. And they said that they were talking about how they did a minute by minute Nielsen viewer thing or whatever, and like it was a lead in of 6 million people from Home Improvement, and then it just shows it just go steadily down in 3 minutes to like almost nothing, because wow. The first sketch they did was Dana Carvey doing a Bill Clinton, where he said he wanted to like be both the mother and father of the country. And so it shows him like with all the, he pulls his shirt open, he's got all these nipples, and there's like all these like baby kittens and dogs and just babies like nursing on him and everything. And so like, it's the first sketch anybody sees of this show. And of course they're not going to stay around after watching Home Improvement. And the funniest thing to me in this whole documentary is they show an ad for for ABC's lineup on the night or whatever. And like, I'm going to give a little bit of background that each show of the Dana Carvey show, they were trying to do kind of a joke where they'd have a new sponsor every week. So the first one was like Taco Bell, and then there was like Diet Mug root beer and all this other type of stuff. And so they show this They show this ABC programming thing, and it was like a very special home improvement. The loss of a child is horrible or whatever. And it shows all these people like hugging and like, we're going to get through this. We're going to get through this. It's a, watch, home, a very special home improvement, followed by Diet Mug Root Beer. Diet Mug Root Beer and the Dana Carvey Show. And they show this to Colbert, and he's just dying. He can't breathe. How inappropriate this this combo is. So I think it's an interesting documentary to watch because it shows you can have everything in the world going for you. You still may not. You have to still have a lot of luck in this.
There's probably a show like this every generation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is reminding me of the Ben Stiller Show,
yeah,
in that it was short-lived, did not succeed, but was stacked with people who would go on to be famous.
Absolutely.
Same with Freaks and Geeks, which was a more traditional scripted show,
mm-hmm,
but canceled too soon, stacked with people who would go on to be super famous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it just shows, like you're saying, even the best intended, best circumstances can still go awry.
Yeah.
If it just doesn't all cohese.
Yeah. Yeah, you really do have to have a lot of luck. You have to have the right set of circumstances. It doesn't matter who you have working for you. So.
Well, I'm going to stick right in the mid '90s. I mean, your documentary is new, but it's about something from the mid '90s.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go with my other small recommend, another movie I caught the other day. For the first time in a few years, The American President.
Oh, yeah.
1995. This is a really enjoyable film. This is Rob Reiner directing, Aaron Sorkin writing, mm-hmm, same team behind A Few Good Men, although this is lighter than that.
Oh, yeah.
It is kind of cute now at what politics and scandals looked like, at least to Hollywood in 1996, because the big scandal is that first the president is dating. And honestly, if we had a single president today who was dating, I think that would be the top story every single day. Did she sleep over? What did she wear?
Mm-hmm.
Home wrecker, whatever. I think that would kind of happen. But then, like, she was at a protest where people were burning bras and flags and stuff. And that's like a big scandal. That's the scandal. And, mm-hmm, like, today, you wouldn't even make the paper for that. Like, you have to be so much more extreme today. But the reason I love this movie is it's basically a prequel to The West Wing. And I don't think they knew it when they were making it. But both The West Wing and this movie show the perfect balance of a realistic politics and an optimistic politics.
Yeah.
Because in this movie, the president, you know, he acknowledges that he's not going to get all the Republican votes for this one bill he wants.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got to, you know, play give and take with certain things. There's a moment where he has to go authorize a strike in some country to retaliate for something. And you know, he hates this part of the job. He's the perfect president in that, you know, he's fair. He's even-minded. And I just love the optimism of this. This is what I thought politics was in 1980 when I'm 5 years old. I thought it was all pretty fair, occasional scandals, but good people trying to do good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have that opinion anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But the movie's still good. It's still, the dialogue still crackles. Michael J. Fox and David Paymer,
yeah,
are still hilarious. The relationship between Martin Short's not in this movie. Martin Sheen and Michael Douglas, I think is really layered and,
yeah,
interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a great argument there where he,
oh, I love that,
says, you know, you never had the balls to run, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Just really, really good stuff. Especially, I guess maybe this is like a salve right now for your political wounds.
Mm-hmm.
If you're, you know, looking at today's political landscape and not liking what you see, watch this movie and,
mm-hmm,
escape for a couple hours into what it should look like, at least in an, mm-hmm, optimist's heart.
Yeah.
That is a movie you can find, and I gotta find out where you can watch this. I'm supposed to do my homework. If you have a premium subscription, you can watch it on Hulu, Amazon Prime. It's on Stars. That's probably where I saw it.
Yeah,
premium Roku. But The American President, 1995.
So why are you always still one step behind me, AJ? Why is that? So because if I wasn't, you'd be the most popular history professor at the University of Wisconsin. They throw some fucks around in this PG-13 movie, too. There's three of them in that movie. And like, yep. They got away with it, so good for them.
Good for them.
All right, so I'm going to recommend Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness.
Ooh.
So watching this movie last week, I didn't really have any intention to watching it. It was just some friends were like, hey, we're going to go see this movie. Do you want to see it? And I was like, eh, sure. Why not? If we are going to constantly deride Marvel for not branching out and doing something different, then it would be kind of hypocritical of us to be like, this movie went too far away from what they were doing and I don't like it. Now, that doesn't mean I necessarily had to like it just because it did something different. That's a completely different thing. But I really do feel like Sam Raimi had the power here to like say, I'm going to do a movie that I really want to branch out. I want to make something completely different here. Now, I don't know where this was in script phase. I don't know how Scott Derrickson was about to do this. I don't know anything about that. All I know is that Sam Raimi, this is a Sam Raimi movie somehow in the middle of this like big Marvel machine. He somehow made his own thing in this. And it is so distinctly different, and that's maybe a redundant set of words there, but it's so distinct that I was enthralled by the directions it took. Everybody's talking about the horror aspects of this movie, and that's very true. He goes pretty deep into the horror stuff. There's some very Sam Raimi things in this, Drag Me to Hell kind of stuff in here. And the multiverse never gets too complex. There's about, I don't know, four or five trips into different universes in this movie. And the powers are well defined. The young girl who has has only one power, and that is to move between multiverses. That's all she, and she doesn't know how to do it. How would somebody like Doctor Strange react to somebody with this power? How would somebody like Scarlet Witch, played great, Elizabeth Olsen's getting all a lot of props, and she should in this. This is an extension of her WandaVision performance that everybody loved. It's one of these type of movies where I can see why there are a lot of people who are upset about this. I can understand why it dropped so steeply in its second weekend. But it goes to show, look, I'm not a big fan of Marvel deciding we need to make everything samey and we're going to fire these directors who try to go anywhere different with it and all that. I'm not a big fan of that. I think you have to grow. I'm not a big fan of The Last Jedi, but Rian Johnson tried something there, and yep, I madly respect that.
Yeah.
You cannot keep being beholden to the same old shit over and over and over again. Eventually, you are going to tire your audience out.
Yep.
And yes, this movie may have not been the movie that people will continue to want to watch over the years. This may not be their bag, really, when it comes down to it. But you got to try something. Otherwise, you're just watching the same old shit over and over and over again. And I already got tired of it, and this was a breath of fresh air for me. So I am all in on this one. So, I'm sure I'll watch it again and I'll be like, yeah, okay. Wasn't as good as I was when I first watched it, but I admire the hell out of Sam Raimi for making something different. So
that's awesome. I have heard more mixed reaction across the entire spectrum on this movie than maybe any other Marvel movie before, but you have made me interested again, sir, and I appreciate it. And that is knowing that I am spoiled all to hell about this movie.
Sure.
And this time it wasn't some jerk-ass doing it on purpose. It was Twitter not getting their shit together in time. anyway, I'm glad to hear that you liked it so much, and I'm glad to hear there's so much Raimi in there. That, I think, even if the movie's a B-minus or a C-plus, I'll still enjoy the Raimi stuff.
Oh yeah. Has his fingerprints all over it, and and just a unique story too. This is a real Civil War type movie to me. This is one where the actual wants and needs of the protagonist changing one to a protagonist and one to an antagonist makes more sense than it did in Civil War. It's interesting to empathize with an antagonist so much because she's been such a protagonist. She was started off as an antagonist and then became a protagonist. And now she's an antagonist again. But you're sitting there going,
"Where should we go from here?"
Yeah. So now I'm like, "Oh, I totally understand where she's coming from." It's a little bit of a ripoff of Cloverfield Paradox, just a little bit. Just a tiny bit, Cloverfield Paradox, but in the end, I really, really enjoyed it. So,
all right. Well, I think that brings us to this week's big recommend.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
That's right. The big recommend for this episode is 1999's The Insider, directed by Michael Mann, starring Al Pacino and Russell Crowe. And this is a movie that came out in 1999, and because 1999 was so rad, I think this movie got overlooked a little bit. I can't remember if this got, it may have gotten nominated though for Best Picture or something like that. I can't remember if it did. I'm gonna look it up real quick, because that's good radio and good.
It is
live stuff. Nominated for 7 Oscars actually for Best Picture and Best Director. So yeah, it got some Oscar love, but I don't think people remember it. When you say 1999, you're not gonna eventually just think of this movie. But
yeah,
it's another one of the many that came out in this year that's great. I think The Insider shows us, much like how broadcast news was sort of telling us back in the 80s, that the business side of news has really sort of, I mean, it doesn't say that in the text, but the business side of news has really fucked us here in the US because the media doesn't really work off of what people need to know. They're working off what people, they want people to hear and what will keep them tuned in. And
billionaire who owns them wants them to write.
Yeah, exactly. There's a point even where Al Pacino says, who's got a free press? Steve Tisch has got a free press. And, the movie is about, a chemist played by Russell Crowe who is fired from Brown and Williamson, a tobacco company. What he knows is that they put a drug inside of cigarettes that keep people wanting to come back to smoke more. As the discussion is between Lowell Bergman, played by Al Pacino, and the rest of his producers and everything, is that, the news that he has isn't that cigarettes are bad for you. That's not news. Everybody knows that cigarettes are bad for you. But what would be something that would really hurt these guys? Well, if they're putting something in their product that makes people come back as an addiction, then that's real, real news there. So it's interesting too. And this, I didn't really notice this the first few times that I watched this, because I knew the story so much that I didn't really think about how Lowell Bergman ends up talking to, Jeffrey Wigand. And it's because he gets a delivery, at his home, from Philip Morris about the burn rates of paper or something like that. In his investigative, techniques or whatever, he's calling around trying to figure out who can make sense of this. And eventually he ends up on Jeffrey Wigand. When he calls his house, and it's his wife, played by Diane Venora, who was in Heat, the previous Michael Mann movie. Diane Venora tells him, you know, he goes, I'm with 60 Minutes. I'd like to talk with your husband. She immediately thinks it must be because of what he knows about Brown and Williamson. And so she goes, he's not interested in talking to you. And he goes, well, you don't even know what I want to talk to you about. And she goes, don't want to know. So he's instantly curious about this and eventually calls Wigand, and Wigand acts very suspicious and saying, I don't want to talk to you. And the reason why he's so scared is because he signed a confidentiality agreement, that if he breaks it, then he loses his, insurance, and he loses his half pay, and he loses all this type of stuff. So obviously there's a very big reason why he doesn't want to talk to Lowell Bergman, but Bergman is just, all he is wants to know about this Philip Morris thing, but now he's like, whoa, this guy has something really juicy. I love also the fact that this movie paints a lot of different stories, what's going on around the world at this time. You know, the very first thing is, and this movie gets you right in, by the way, 2.5 hours. It gets right in. As soon as the credits roll, it's like, doom, 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 doom. And it's like, it's just there's a piece of cloth over the camera. And that's basically representing, Lowell Bergman's trip, to talk to the leader of Hezbollah. They want to talk to him after a bombing of the U.S. embassy. He wants to dictate all the questions and all that. And he goes, we don't do that. You know, we're not biased or anything like that. We run a great show, so you can either take it or not. And they eventually agree on it. And Mike Wallace, once they come in, Mike Wallace, the first question he asks of the Hezbollah guy is, are you a terrorist? Very first question, before they even warmed up into anything. And then there's the O.J. Simpson trial. There is the Unabomber. There is a lot of different things going on all at once that Lowell Bergman, he's not just working on this cigarette story. He's working on a million different things all at once in this. It just goes to show that there's just never ends on all of this. So anyway, what did you think of this movie?
Okay, so this is my first time watching since I quit smoking, which gave me a new view of the evils of these companies. Now, when this comes out in 1999, I'd been smoking for maybe 3 years, maybe four. Mm-hmm. I was in that fuck you, I won't do what you told me mode. I would make jokes about how it wasn't bad for me. I was an idiot. I was far from thinking this movie, I didn't connect this movie to my life at all, even though I was a smoker. Mm-hmm. Now that I'm 4+ years of cleaner lungs, free from smoking, this movie made me angry. Even if some of it's fictionalized, you know, the general idea that there's a section where one guy in the newsroom meeting just goes off explaining how these guys never lose. They bat 1,000. They will stew you into oblivion until you are bankrupt. They never lose. And I believe that about them. And I know, obviously now they knew what they were putting in there. But I really enjoyed this movie this time through. Hadn't seen it in maybe 8-9 years. I'm so impressed with both the lead actors' relative subdued performances.
Yeah.
There are a couple of scenes where Pacino gets his shout on.
Yeah, a little bit.
But, you know, this is coming off of Gladiator for Russell Crowe, mm-hmm. right?
No, it's just before Gladiator.
Just before Gladiator.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, it's a complete polar opposite kind of performance. This is a very subdued, quiet man. A lot of his dialogue is not dialogue. It's just watching him think and work through stuff. It's really a good performance. Everybody is in this. I forgot how good this cast is.
Oh, yeah.
I made a few notes here that I want to make sure I touch on.
Mm-hmm.
That scene with the meeting where the guy's explaining how the tobacco companies never lose, and they're talking about Wiegand and should they run this interview, or do this interview. And I just thought it was really interesting that Wiegand's life is in the balance. He's literally being stalked and harassed, and they're just having a casual lunch. There's even a scene where Mike Wallace makes a comment and then says, pass the milk.
Yeah.
And I don't think that is on accident. I think that's there to show a little bit of that privilege of distance, which I think Lowell, the character, Al Pacino's character, eventually throughout the film, you know, breaks through that because it's clear he cares about Jeffrey, you know, especially by the end of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing like Mike Wallace going off on the suits who edited him.
Oh, that was fantastic. One scene
where he's like, well, I don't know what he says, but he's basically like, you well, have balls to edit me?
Gina Gershon, who has come in as a CBS corporate and is telling them they can't run this segment, and they're talking about this stuff like tortious interference, where apparently if you're a third party that tells someone or compels someone to reveal information in a confidentiality agreement, you are just as liable as the person giving the information. But you know, there's extra layers to it because CBS is up for sale to, I can't remember which cigarette company.
Westinghouse.
It was Westinghouse. And
I don't even think they're a cigarette company. I think they're just a huge conglomerate.
Oh yeah. So there's the sale is in peril because this other company doesn't want to touch another company that could get sued into oblivion. And she's saying that, you know, it's if by the end of litigation, Brown and Williamson could own this company. So she's going in pretending to be a friend, basically. We're all on the same side here. We're on this, blah, 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 blah. And then Mike Wallace is very proud of his. Now, of course, Mike Wallace, the real Mike Wallace, had a lot of issues with this movie. I don't blame him. But, you know, if they didn't ask him what his, you know, what really happened, and they didn't want to tell his side, and they wanted to make him this, I'm going along with corporate too, and whatever. But he tells CBS News, he gives an interview with CBS News saying this is all the stuff that you're going to miss in this edited version of our interview tonight. And all it comes down to is, will there be information that they won't be, that the people will not be able to see tonight? And he shows him going, yes. And that's it. And so Gina Gershon, who keeps going Mike all the way through this, never calls him Mr. Wallace or anything. She's like Mike, and he goes Mike, how about Mr. Wallace? And he's like, just because we work in the same company doesn't mean we work in the same business. And yeah. and then he talks to Stephen Tobolowsky too, who's the other guy, the other kind of the villain in this, is like, who told you that you had the requisite skills to edit me? And blah, blah, blah. So yeah, I loved all that. But it goes to show news organizations just are not independent anymore. They're trying to make money, and everybody loses that way, and it's why we've gotten to where we've gotten. Like I said, Broadcast News was one of the first movies I ever saw that had that, and I hope I'm not stealing your double feature, but we'll get to that in a minute. But Broadcast News, very first scene of that movie is talking about how Holly Hunter's talking about how this is the story that ran on this news channel, and it's like
Domino's.
Yeah, it's Domino's. It's fucking Domino's. And she goes, is this news? Everybody's walking out, and someone goes, yeah, thank God. Exactly. I'm glad it is, or something like that. Just basically saying that's what she hopes news is. And it's just, and it's not, I know that there's a need to be entertained and not feel bad or I guess feel bad, but still be riveted to watch. I know that there's that kind of thing, but we're missing out on that type of stuff. And that's what this movie, even though that's not in the, like, that's not like the main thing that they're going after in this. It is a byproduct of what we've been seeing.
You can almost call the tobacco companies in this movie the mentor to the news organization, who's like the apprentice at being evil and money minded, right? Because tobacco companies aren't even, there's not even debates going on anymore. They're not only like, let's make money and kill people. They're like, let's do it faster. Let's put more of that shit in there. And then the news companies are like, should we or shouldn't we? But, you know, we already know where they're going to be 20 years down the road.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to point out that I was struck by this time was how opposite side of the coin this guy is to Walter White from Breaking Bad.
Mm.
They both worked for as scientists for a big company and were unceremoniously pushed out, then turned to teaching chemistry because of their passion for it.
Yeah.
And one of them turned all the way evil, and Wigand just, no matter how many fucking potholes he hits, he just keeps driving straight to the good. I'm going to do the right thing. My wife is mad. My kids are gone. They're trying to kill me. I've been slandered all over the whole U.S., but I'm still going to do the right thing. Like, he's the polar opposite, but they have that shared, I love that scene of him teaching. Just because you see, just like with that, with Walter White, you see the passion for the chemistry there, which I think is kind of, I don't know, what propels the character. I think the chemistry love is what informs his sense of right and wrong.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, I was struck by a Breaking Bad comparison. I'm happy to see everyone in the comments trying to steal my thunder on the super secret double feature.
I this is one of these movies that we could go to scene after scene after scene of how many great things are going on. But I do want to mention also Bruce McGill in this movie because, and also just the lawyering that Wigand gets. Like, I don't think we get to see this very often in movies. The lawyers really want him to testify so that this interview can get out. And they want him to testify because they have a completely different kind of litigation going on in Mississippi. It's a different kind of area. It's not about the addiction. It's just more about, I think it's about insurance, cigarettes
too.
Like that. It's something, in a different zone, but, they still would like his testimony and it would help him with the case, but it would also allow CBS to play the interview. And they tell him right up front, and he goes, there's a problem with you testifying. And that is, once you step back into Kentucky, they can arrest you and put you in jail. Now, this is also an interesting too thing. Like, you know, like the privileged white male, he's like, how does one go to jail is what he says at one point.
Yeah.
And exactly. Yeah. If you don't know that world, then what is that like? Right. What is that like to say, to do the right thing and be in jail? But they tell him that up front. They says, we would really like your testimony, but you should know all the consequences to this. And you don't see that very often, I don't think, in movies at all. And when it gets to the point where he has to make the decision, there's this period where he's just out looking out at the water and he's trying to make the right decision. And finally, Lowell Bergman shows up and he goes, all right, what's the decision? And he goes, every time he keeps thinking about what's the right thing to do, it just doesn't come. It just comes down to the fact that he needs to do what's right and screw the consequences is what it comes down to. It's like what you're saying. He goes, okay, fuck it. So they go back and they go to do this deposition and Bruce McGill is like, is trying to get him to say that it acts like a drug. It acts like a drug. And the counsel for, I guess Big Tobacco is like, he's like, It's like, you have signed a confidentiality agreement. You are not to answer that question. And he goes, that means you don't talk. And he says, yeah, we have rights here. He said, we have rights here. And Bruce McGill's like, oh, we have rights and lefts and middles. So what? You don't get to instruct anything here. And then the guy's like, does this little like smirk on his face or whatever. He's like, no, wipe that smirk off your face. This is not North Carolina, nor South Carolina, nor Kentucky. And he's like, Mr. Wygant's deposition will be part of this record, you know? And it's,
and then it cuts to the court reporter lady, and she's like going, looking left, and then right, yeah, and then left.
Yeah. So that Bruce McGill and all the lawyering going on in there is great. And by the way, what about the guy who plays James Snodgrass in Quiz Show showing up in this movie?
Yeah, yeah, as another like creepy kind of person.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, yeah. Like I said, we could probably spend another 20 minutes or so talking about scenes we loved in The Insider. It's that kind of movie. There's just nothing but great scenes all the way through it. And this is one of the last great Al Pacino. I mean, there's some decent Al Pacino that has come out after this, but this is the first time, this is in the '90s. This is one of the first times you're going to see him in sort of a reserve. I mean, Donnie Brasco was obviously one of his best in the '90s, but only a couple of times does he get into that whole, like, you know, are you a newsman or a businessman? You know, all these, he's like, when he tells him, no, you fucked you. Stop inverting, yeah, stuff. You know, that type of stuff. There's some Al Pacino bombast in this, but it, all in all, it's pretty well reserved. So anyway, I think it's time that we get to your super secret double feature. And I hope, not because I hate you, Chat, but I hope that you have a different movie than Chat.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Yes, so far no one in chat has named the movie I'm going to choose, or even the ones I strongly considered. You guys probably know by now, I either choose a double feature by, like, tone,
mm-hmm,
or by theme, or by topic,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So if I were to go by theme, I almost chose Donnie Brasco.
Oh, yeah.
For the idea of the system letting down the guy who's just trying to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
I almost went, if we were going to go topical, I almost went Citizen Four, the documentary about Ed Snowden,
mm-hmm,
from the hotel room.
Yeah.
Because it's straight up an informer. I almost went The Informant. The exact opposite of
I actually
Jeffrey
thought
Wygant.
Of The Informant during this too.
But I have decided to go with The Rainmaker.
Oh, The Rainmaker. Good
specifically
one.
Specifically because of how it exposes a huge corporation's true evil.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically that scene where he has the mother up on the stand read one of the letters the insurance company sent her after she kept asking them to cover this treatment. And the guy says, you must be stupid, stupid, stupid. And then you later find out from Virginia Madsen that they had a whole section in the manual that's not public that told them to deny every claim. And math tells us only a certain number of people will be persistent enough, and that will keep our costs down. So much the way that The Insider exposes the true evils of big tobacco, if you weren't aware of them already, I think The Rainmaker exposes the true evils of insurance companies. You also get a really great, subdued young Matt Damon, and Claire Danes, young Claire Danes. This is a very well-acted, solid film, and that would be my double feature.
That was the movie that came out the summer before Good Will Hunting came out, so people were still not entirely sure who Matt Damon was at the time, but that was like a good stepping stone into Good Will Hunting, because Rainmaker was a pretty decent hit. I don't know if it was a huge hit, but it was a pretty decent one, and that was Francis Ford Coppola too.
Mm-hmm.
Who just
cast Adam Driver in his next movie.
Yep. Oh yeah.
Hey.
Yep. John Voight in this movie. He's in that movie as well.
Oh, the John Voight.
John Voight.
Just driving around in John Voight's car.
Yeah, exactly.
So next week's homework for Recotopia episode 17. It's going to be hell or high water.
Yep.
This is Chris Pine and Ben Foster and Jeff Bridges in a movie I have raved about before, but still too few people have seen it. And I think you guys should be exposed to it so that we can dive deep into its many, many layers.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see if I can find where that is. Gotta do show prep, Jeremy. I mean, you can find it in my Blu-ray collection, but... Oh, it's on Netflix. That's groovy. that's probably as wide a distribution for our listenership as any other service.
So, yeah.
Hell or High Water is next week's homework.
Yep, and that's an excellent movie. Can't wait to revisit it. I think I watched it last when we did a best of 2015 thing, and so it's been since then since I've seen it, so I'll be looking forward to going back and looking at that. So,
all right.
Questions?
I believe we have time for a couple of questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
First question. What is your favorite and least favorite fact about a specific movie? hit us.
Yeah, I mean, generally, it's going to be like, for me, it's going to be like you heard about some sort of abusive techniques that the director did or whatever on a movie that you love or whatever. But it's funny. I was looking. I found something horrible about Wizard of Oz. And then I was like, okay, what would be my favorite thing about that? And I actually had to sit there and look at a whole bunch of like facts about Wizard of Oz and found like five or six other really bad things about the Wizard of Oz. Like they didn't treat people very well back in the day. There was a point like where Judy Garland laughed at one of the actors getting slapped or something. And so Victor Fleming, who was the director at the time, went and slapped Judy Garland, who was 16.
Oh my God.
And
oh
then,
my God.
And then apparently that shows up in one of her takes about halfway through the movie that she was just recovering from, basically. And like Fleming apparently like was very torn up about it. This is another thing that's kind of fucked up. He was torn up about it, saying, oh my God, I hope this doesn't ruin our relationship, blah, 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 blah. Judy Garland heard it. And then she was like okay with it or something because he overheard. And it just seems so weird and fucked up. And one of the facts that I noticed that was in a lot of different things was the fact that the dog who played Toto got paid more than the actors who played in the Lollipop Guild. That was a bad fact for Wizard of Oz. Apparently he got paid $125, the dog that played Toto, per day, I guess, and the actors got paid $50 a day. So I was like, all right, let's try to find some good stuff on Wizard of Oz, and like just kept running into like, you know, of course they had all the they had all that stuff about, you know, the using the actual aluminum paint that Buddy Ebsen couldn't breathe or whatever because he had an allergic reaction to it. And then he lost the role because he couldn't do it. And there was they used asbestos for the snow in that one scene. They used asbestos. And I'm like, God damn, is there anything good about The Wizard of Oz, the making of The Wizard of Oz? But the effect of the tornado is one of my favorite facts about it. They use this muslin stocking with dirt and dust swirling around it to create the effect of the tornado in the movie. So I thought that was really cool. You think about a movie back in 1939 trying to get an effect of a tornado, and that's how they did it, and it's really well done for a movie that's, you know, 80 something years old at this point. That's a fun fact, but man, oh man, were there a lot of transgressions in making The Wizard of Oz.
Jeez. That sounds awful. I'm gonna go off book, but recently my brother and I sat with my nephew, his oldest child, and watched Alien and Aliens.
Ah, yes.
And I've probably mentioned this before in other incarnations of other podcasts, but my favorite fact is also my least favorite fact, and that is in Alien that the director and the actor did not tell any of the other actors that the alien was going to pop out.
Right, just. Right.
And I think that is both awesome and horrifying. Mm. Like, I think that is exactly on the line about behavior that gets something out of your actors due to spontaneity, but is borderline emotionally abusive. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only reason I don't push it all the way is that those actors, no matter how surprised they were, none of them could possibly have thought that was a real alien.
Yeah.
And their brain almost instantly had to go, as somebody who did a lot of shitty improv back in my college years, you adjust pretty quick on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
You know you're acting. You know cameras are rolling. So you're startled. And then the rest of that scene, I think, is them going, oh, he wanted us to be scared. I'm just going to play into it.
Mm-hmm.
But still, if I were one of those actors, I probably would walk over and have words with the director for not warned me that was going to happen.
He's like, hey, look, I'm an actor. You know, like you'd be like... You'd be like the guy in Die Hard, played by Hart Bochner, where you're like, hey, Hans, this is radio. I mean, not television. What am I, a method actor? You know, over on the chat, we have a favorite from JC Davis's Kate Winslet Flash Leo prior to filming Titanic. And then least favorite is James Cameron did Molly Brown dirty. And then one.
He had help.
Nick says best and worst thing about watching Kevin Spacey movies is that Kevin Spacey is in them. Yep. That's totally true. I mean, it's a horrible human being with great performances. There you go. Tarantino spitting in his actor's face. That would be a bad one. Sure.
Kubrick in The Shining.
That was the thing about The Shining. I thought about that one too, how they made, but the problem is that I argue that Shelley Duvall's performance is not very good in The Shining. All that work that he did to try to make her feel this way, and she ended up not doing a very good job, really. I don't think, and that's, I don't put that on her.
No. All right, next question. When has something that's largely innocuous bothered you or pulled you out of what for you is otherwise a good or even great movie? For example, and this is a cinema sin for sure.
Mm-hmm.
In First Man, it bothers me to no end that Ryan Gosling is notably shorter than Corey Stoll and Pablo Shriver, yet Armstrong and Lovell were the same height, and Aldrin is shorter than both.
Yep. Knowing that takes me right out of that. But you know, there's a. When's the last time you saw Poltergeist? The first Poltergeist.
Man, when we send it.
Probably. Yeah.
If we send it.
Well, when I had not seen it up until I had seen it a couple of times before we send it, and then when we send it. There's a section that we actually send in it because it was so jarring. There's a moment in that, you remember the scene where Craig T. Nelson comes back and like there's been paranormal activity in the kitchen, the chairs moved across the floor and all that. Well, he comes back and Joe Beth Williams is trying to tell him this is what happened while you were gone. And she's in the middle, and she goes, and she's like, and it's kind of like this, like blah, blah, blah. And it cuts in the middle of her sentence straight to Craig T. Nelson and Joe Beth Williams at the neighbor's house in the midst of another conversation completely. I mean, it's like an art film gone wrong type of edit that they throw in Poltergeist. And I read up on this, and the reason why it was cut so abruptly was that there's dialogue that comes later where she wants to go to Pizza Hut, and Craig T. Nelson says, I hate Pizza Hut. And Pizza Hut got wind of it and said, and I guess got enough mad about it and had enough power to override fucking Steven Spielberg, the producer on this movie.
The producer.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? I mean,
who knows?
He may have also directed it too. Who knows? But Toby Hooper and all these people, they just like they were able to say, hey, we hate that. And they're able to successfully chop that. They're successfully able to chop out a piece of the movie without any like pickup or anything, like not even a cutaway to something else. Like it makes no sense whatsoever. But anyway, that takes me out of the movie for a bit.
That's a funny story. Pizza Hut.
Mm-hmm.
Nightmare Alley, which I, small recommended last week and, now seen almost three times all the way through. I'm really digging this movie. But there's one element of it that I don't get that keeps me up at night. The movie opens with Bradley Cooper getting off a train, and there's a circus in this town.
Mm-hmm.
And he stumbles over to the circus and ends up getting a job to help them tear down the circus
because mm-hmm.
they're about to move up the road. And I'm like, okay, this is a traveling circus. And they move up the road 20 miles, they say, and they merge with another circus that's there. And then they're just there forever.
Mm-hmm.
They never travel again. David Strathairn lives there with Cate Blanchett in this house, and everybody in the circus knows that.
Yeah.
So it's almost like the only reason the circus travels at all is to get Cooper's character a job, to get him hooked into the circus life,
mm-hmm.
because they go up the road and then they're there for like years.
Yeah, that's weird. That is really weird. Yeah.
They never go anywhere else. They never go back 20 miles to the other place.
Like, even an explanation as to like their regional or something like that, where they go 20 minutes somewhere, 20 miles away just for a special thing, a holiday or something, and then come back. They don't even really explain that even. So that is, it's obviously, it's a plot device to get him in there. Yeah.
So anyway, even my brother, when we were watching the movie, I turned to him and I was like, well, is this circus traveling or stationary? He was like, I really don't know.
Mm-hmm. No,
all right, let's do at least one more.
All right.
What is a movie you just can't finish, no matter how much you tried?
Well, you know, this is the same kind of question in a way as the ones that you walked out on, right? I typically, when I start a movie, will finish it. It doesn't matter how bad it is, and I will struggle through some really bad ones sometimes, but it's that whole thing like that old South Park where, you know, Cartman hears the first bars of Come Sail Away and he has to sing the whole song afterwards every time. I do not have a movie that I've started and have not been able to finish. The only movie that I've ever walked out on and did never finish, but I've never tried to finish, is Dungeons and Dragons. And I have talked about that before. I watched the first reel. I was working at Hollywood 27. We watched the first reel or two of Dungeons and Dragons. And I was like, man, I'm tired. This movie's terrible. I'm going to do something that I've never done before, and that is stop this and just let it run through the night without me even watching it. And I may have cut what was had already played and put it back in the middle and told the people in the morning to make sure that they watched, made sure that it went through okay. But I was just like, I'm not watching the rest of this. And I just didn't, and I still haven't. So,
yeah, if my big trigger happens in the middle of a movie, I won't ever go back and finish it. I won't even try. And that's happened a few times.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of movies I've walked out of, that I'm sure I've mentioned at least one of these before. Sarah Michelle Gellar's Simply Irresistible.
Oh yeah.
The magical crab cooking assistant movie.
Mm-hmm.
I walked out before that was done.
Mm-hmm.
I walked out before Batman v Superman was done. And I never went back.
I say that you did watch, I think, up till the funeral, right? Like you walked out before the funeral was done.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you watched most of that at least. So
even Simply Irresistible, I believe it was the last scene because the conflict is over and it cuts to this dance and it shows the fucking crab in a tuxedo, and I literally said, that's it. And mm-hmm. I got up and I walked out. There was only three other people in the auditorium.
Yeah.
But, I'm pretty sure. I don't think I've walked out of anything in the theater halfway through.
Mm-hmm.
But Dungeons and Dragons, I would have. I'm
sure. And look, I honestly, it may not be the worst movie I've ever watched. I've seen probably worse movies. It's just with the circumstances involved, being that horrible as it was, and then me being super tired and not really wanting to put up with it. It was a rare occurrence. Like I sat through every Uwe Boll movie that ever came into Hollywood 27. I watched every one of those things. So I've seen probably worse, but Dungeons and Dragons, I could not finish. So
we got a comment here from Josh that says Mission Impossible 2 makes me want to punch a dolphin.
Yeah.
He also says he couldn't finish The Cell because nothing ever happened. That's true.
There's
a lot of cool visuals, but not a lot of plot in that
movie. JC is talking about, you know, wonder if the guy Chris heard about fucking corny shit. That was Miami Vice, by the way, was when I was watching Miami Vice, and an usher who had come in to watch it with me got up and said, fucking corny shit, and walked out. And I doubt he went back. I doubt it. I very highly doubt it. So.
All right. Well, I think that is probably going to wrap it up for this episode.
Yep.
Of Wreckatopia. I think we want to once again thank our live chat, live viewers.
Absolutely.
We appreciate your being here and your time and your input to the show. Your homework for next week is Hell or High Water, which you can find on Netflix. Any final thoughts?
No, I'm looking forward to seeing Hell or High Water again, is all. I think it's I've seen it 3 times, but I'm looking forward to seeing it a 4th. That's the kind of movie. So anyway, yeah. Thank you all in chat once again. Yes, again. We will see you next time. So see ya.
Goodbye.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Like, I think at this point it's like going for 4th down in the NFL, right?
Mm-hmm,
if you succeed, you're a genius. If you don't make it, you're an idiot. Every single time. There's no failing. Maybe once I've heard an announcer go, well, they didn't make it, but that was still the right call. It's just about the outcome. So
it kind of is. Yeah. And there's really, even when you get the nerds come on and say, well, you know, it's got this kind of whatever, and they don't have nobody has a real answer. I think there are some clear cases to me, like, you know, when Harbaugh went for two with the Ravens last year, like two times towards the end of the, like, why is going for the win there? Why does that give you a better chance to win than going into overtime and winning a coin toss?
Right.
I don't understand why not just go ahead and kick the extra point and then you take your chances in overtime. You're taking your chances going for two. So I've never understood that kind of rationale. Like, yeah, I understand the nerdy part of it, and I'm all about the nerdy part of it, but a lot of times I'm sitting there thinking, yeah, the other team has Peyton Manning. They can run the clock down. They can get down there in a blink of an eye because it's Peyton Manning. But wouldn't you rather try to prevent them from getting to the 30-yard, your own 30, than just giving it to them? And I guess, you know, if you get it, you get the first down, then that ends the game and you don't have to worry about it.
That was always Belichick in my mind, at least as a Colts fan in the Peyton Manning era, is that he always wanted to step on our throats. He always wanted to... If we were on the ground, he was going to kick us. If he had already kicked us, he was going to step on our face. He wanted to hurt us. And the few times we overcame them was bliss. I tell you, bliss. I got a box of edible arrangement as a gift. And it's like chocolate-covered strawberries. I don't understand that business. I mean, it's a lovely gift. You're never going to get really fresh strawberries this way.
That's true.
Right? Like, and that's obviously not the point, but every time, this is maybe the 3rd or 4th time somebody has, over my lifetime, gifted me one of these edible arrangements. Usually it's like a bunch of fruit on a stick. It's got barely a little chocolate on it. But it's always like day old or 2 day old fruit because they have to get it from wherever they get it from. And then they have to dip it and drizzle it and pretty it and put it in a package and wrap it up, and then they have to, in this instance, they called me to see if I was home to receive delivery of it. If I hadn't been, what do they bring it the next day? Oh, it's even fresher.
Right. Like, right.
Flowers at least live for a couple weeks, maybe a week.
Mm-hmm.
But strawberries is something like if I'm going to eat a strawberry, I kind of want to pick it right out of the ground.
Yeah.
Maybe chill it for an hour and then go.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a business model I don't understand.
Yeah. I don't quite get that either. I mean, yeah. What's the limit to? What's the limit to when they can deliver it? And
right. What if I'm on vacation? Nobody told me it was coming.
Yeah.
And then do they just give it to somebody else and remake mine in a week?